Episode of Progress, Potential, and Possibilities, discussions with fascinating people designing a better tomorrow for all of us. I'm your host, Ira Pastor.
Welcome everybody again to another episode of our show, bringing you another fascinating guest today who is helping and has helped create a better tomorrow for many years on many different fronts. Today we have the honor of being joined by Dr. John LaMattina, who is currently non-executive director at the PureTech organization, which is a biotech company focused on discovering, developing, and commercializing novel therapies for diseases with a significant unmet medical need. Dr. LaMattina previously served as president of Pfizer's global R&D organization. He held positions of increasing responsibility over several decades there, including as vice president of U.S. discovery operations, senior vice president of worldwide discovery, and senior VP of worldwide development, overseeing the development of many Pfizer's major blockbusters, including Chantix, Zoloft, Lyrica, just to name a few. He also serves on the board of directors of many small and developing biotech companies, including Ligand Pharmaceuticals, Zafgen, Immunome, Vandanta Biosciences. Serves on the scientific advisory board of Frequency Therapeutics. He's a trustee associate of Boston College. And in addition to doing all of that, he is an accomplished author. His most recent book, Pharma and Profits, Balancing Innovation, Medicine, and Drug Prices, just recently came out. You can also look for his Devalued and Distrusted, Can the Pharma Industry Restore Its Broken Image? Drug Truths, Dispelling the Myths About Pharma R&D. And he also has his column at Forbes.com, Drug Truths. John has a bachelor's in chemistry from Boston College, his PhD in organic chemistry, University of New Hampshire. A lot of exciting topics to get into today. We're honored to have him. Dr. John LaMattina, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
Ira, thank you for having me, and thank you for the very kind introduction. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great seeing you. It's been a couple years since we last chatted, and when we did talk last, we spent some time going through your long history of developing products, not just in big pharma, but also sort of your work in venture capital and in guiding some of the new development stage companies. And, one thing I'd like to start off with, as we'll get into the book in a couple of minutes, but I'd like to talk a little bit about when first sort of this topic of pharmacoeconomics, this important discipline of looking at the value not of drugs against one another, but of against other therapies, first came into the picture for you as sort of a key parameter, along with obviously safety and efficacy innovation, as a really important part of the drug development process.
Well, I think something that's changed over my now nearly five decades of working in biopharma has been the greater emphasis, and correct emphasis, I believe, on the value of a drug. So you sort of alluded to it already. No longer is it important just to come up with something new to treat a disease. To a certain extent, if it's only as good as what's already out there, which may even be generic, sort of who cares? So one of the things that all companies have to do now, which wasn't necessarily the case 15 years ago, is not only come up with a new drug, but to show its value over existing therapies. And that value could be shown in a variety of different ways. Could be safer. It could be easier to take, fewer side effects. But more likely, the value comes from actually saving the healthcare a whole lot more money than previous therapies. There is a great example that I'll give you that just occurred last week and some of the misconceptions that exist out there. Some years back now, a company, Gilead, came up with a new treatment for hepatitis C, which was a wonderful new treatment in that it cured the disease in 12 weeks. Previous therapies you take for a year, they weren't very good. They only were maybe 40 or 50% effective in curing hepatitis C, which, by the way, is the leading cause of liver cancer, can lead to liver transplants, which costs $300,000 to $400,000 a pop. And so Gilead came out with this. They priced it at $1,000 a pill. So it was an $84,000 treatment. Now, that is list price. And that's an important point for us to keep in mind, the list price of it. And instead of getting kudos for coming up with this wonderful cure for a serious disease, the company got lambasted and everything was focused on price. But I started out talking about value. The fact of the matter is, even at $84,000, there was value added because the previous treatment you had to take for a year, it wasn't as effective, you felt like crap, and that cost close to $100,000 a year. So you had a much better therapy at a somewhat, not a gigantically a different price, but a different price. What happened subsequently was within a year's time, competition appeared for this drug, which was called Sovaldi. And the competition resulted in various insurance companies having Gilead and the first company, AbbVie, and then later Merck, bid against each other. And so the price really plummeted. And now this costs, I believe therapy is like $22,000 for treatment. But last week, and this is what got me on this topic, the Washington Post published a piece called Why Prescription Drugs in the U.S. Is So High. And they focused on the hepatitis C drug, amazingly, only talked about the $84,000 price, which is 5 or 6 years ago. And then said a congressional report came out and said, you know, these companies can raise prices as much as they want, as whatever they want. It's just not true. And this is one case. I can give you a few others. And this is why I care about this, because right now there's all sorts of legislation being considered to put in price controls in the United States. And I think that's going to be a bad move for innovation. Thus, the pharma and profits balancing innovation, medicines, and drug prices. There is so much misconceptions out there, so many. And I don't think people lie when they report on this. They're either lazy journalists or just cherry picking facts and then building a house of cards upon that, which I think needs to be corrected.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, in the book, you know, you lay out in chapter one, the Sovaldi case, and you know, as you write the book, and it's a great read. Everyone can understand what you're talking about. And, you go through that value, $84,000 here, the interferon cocktails and so forth, $100,000. And then you go into cirrhosis, liver cancer, liver transplants, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I understood it. I'm of average intelligence, okay? So I understood it pretty fast. And there's a lot of really smart people in pharma, in the insurance companies, in government that should understand this math. Where do you think some of this math gets lost? And why $1,000 a pill? Like, where's the mystery here that's getting lost, in your opinion?
So I think people would be shocked to learn this whole insulin crisis in terms of insulin pricing, which I have another chapter on in the book. People would be shocked to know that the cost of the amount of money that a company gets for selling these insulins is about 46% of the actual price. So you said 40. Well, where's the rest going to? It's going to pharmacy benefit managers. It's going to the pharmacies. It's going to a variety of different people in the supply chain. If you were to say to somebody, well, you know, I go to the pharmacy and I spend $100 for this drug. Oh, these drug companies are making out like bandits. Well, yeah, but the drug company who researched it for 15 years, who manufactured it, is getting only 46 of those dollars. 40, like, no, how can that be? And then you go through it. Nobody knows this. Our healthcare system is so arcane and so intricate that it's hard for people to appreciate these facts.
In chapter three, you touch on, you know, a story that's been all around us the last couple of years in terms of COVID and the mRNA vaccines, not just, you know, these amazing therapeutics that have come along, but the speed in which they are developed. And then in chapter four, you get into something which, you know, once again, I think gets lost. And it's all about sort of this proportionality with the public, I think, doesn't see that often that, and you equate it to a marathon, sort of thinking that the pharma companies aren't doing much and sort of the public funding is doing most of the marathon. But in reality, the government and public funding is about that first mile. And there's a lot in terms of those billions that go into ultimately taking that bench discovery, that early science, and making that product at the end of the day. And in the case of the mRNA vaccines, really ramping it up quickly. Talk a little bit about, you know, what's happening here and sort of the perception of, you know, pharma just sitting around and collecting and doing some marketing at the end of the day. Where does that go?
So a few points here. Number one, Operation Warp Speed did a great job in terms of guaranteeing six companies that if you're successful, if you come up with a vaccine, if it's shown to be safe and effective, and if the FDA approves it and the CDC put its imprimatur on it, we will buy 100 million doses from you. Well, it was 100 million for five companies. One company, AstraZeneca, whose vaccine was never approved in this country, was guaranteed to buy 300 million doses. So that if you needed an incentive to do this, that was probably the incentive. If you were successful, the government would buy. Of course, at the time, we're in the midst of the pandemic of 100 years. We had in places like New York City, refrigerator trucks being filled with bodies because the morgues couldn't handle them all. Yeah. Hundreds of people dying a day just in that one city across the country. Just an amazing crisis. And what happened, and maybe one silver lining out of all this, is the biopharma industry showed what it does in spades and to try and teach people the value it brought. The FDA wasn't going to cure this. Harvard wasn't going to cure this. It was the biopharma industry that was going to come up with vaccines and therapeutics. But there was risk, and particularly in the mRNA vaccine risk. So I'm an ex-Pfizer guy, right? So you said that, but I haven't been in Pfizer for almost 15 years. So I think I can have a pretty balanced view, and I don't think everything Pfizer's ever done has been perfect anyway. So, but having said that, Pfizer took a tremendous risk in investing what they thought was going to be $1 billion. It turned out to be $2 billion in a technology that was totally unproven. Nobody knew if this would work or not. And furthermore, they took their investment up front to build manufacturing capability long before they knew if they'd have something to work, so that if it did work, people would have it pretty quickly. I think they started in February, and the first injections were given to healthcare workers in late November. Unbelievable achievement, an achievement that they can't take full credit for. Clearly, their partners, BioNTech, had the early technology. All but the delivery and bring it forward, and then bring it forward for a price that was $39 for the two doses and then $19.50 for each dose. Let me put that in perspective for you. The annual flu shot that you get every year, at least for somebody like myself over 60, cost $70. Not that we paid, obviously, insurance-based. That's, you know, more than the annual flu shot, which this year, by the way, was only 15% effective, costs more, about double what the COVID shots cost. Yeah. It amuses me. There was an editorial in New York Times in the summer before the vaccines were proven to work. Say, well, be careful what you wish for, because there are other vaccines like shingles and whooping cough things that can cost $300-$400. So can you imagine what these companies are going to charge for a COVID vaccine? And Elizabeth Rosenthal was postulating it would be $500 for somebody to get vaccinated. Well, it was a whole lot less than that, the $39. But I thought, as a result of all this and the responsibility that these companies have shown, and I just focused on the mRNA vaccines. You have the J&J vaccine. Yep. You've got the therapeutics. You've got antibodies. You've now got the antiviral. Unbelievable how, and it wasn't just one or two companies. Dozens and dozens of companies all sat down and said, what can we do to try and help us? Because look, we're all vulnerable. Their own families were vulnerable. Everybody, neighbors, et cetera. And they did a fantastic job. And I thought this would have would have changed the view of the industry, which it did for a little while. Harris polls and Gallup polls gave the industry some of the highest rankings that they'd ever had. But boy, that's now starting to fall again because everybody's talking about prices and talking about, well, these companies are out of control and insulin, people are dying because they can't get their insulin. Let me also turn to that for a second. You know, and first of all, if the government passes a bill that says nobody can pay more than $35 a month for their insulin, I think that's fabulous, absolutely fabulous. But by the way, nobody knows that 75% of the diabetics in this country already pay $35 or less for their insulin. It's like, whoa, huh? Well, what about the others? Well, a lot of the others are uninsured. So 10% of Americans are uninsured, so they've got to pay out of pocket for their insulin. And without insurance, you're from. That's a whole separate question. Why is anybody in this country uninsured? And shouldn't that be something we're focusing on rather than the $35 aspect? Although I think it'd be great to do. So again, Ira, there are so many of these misconceptions. And so what I tried to do, what I've been trying to do for the last few years, is bring these points out. You know, when I got my booster shots, it cost the government, Medicare, $19.50. Walgreens got $43 for putting a shot in my arm. And they're not unique. That is what Medicare is paying to anybody who puts the shot in. Double, more than double. You got to be kidding me. You know, they have to hire somebody to administer the shots every day. And there's got to be, you know, 100 shots a day going in it from one place, maybe, who knows, maybe more. And by the way, when I went to Walgreens, I didn't just sit there waiting the 10 minutes that you have to wait to make sure you don't have an adverse effect. I bought things. Yep. One of the most incredible pharmacy come-ons in the history of the business. Are you kidding me? And yet nobody knows that. Nobody talks about that. It's the question I was asked by when I was interviewed about mRNA vaccines. And it was a BBC reporter, I believe, who said to me, well, you know, in the first year, Pfizer is going to make $35 billion from their vaccine sales. How much of that should they be allowed to keep? And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. You're saving the world. Pfizer produced 3 billion doses in year one, 4 billion doses in year two. And you're begrudging them the amount of money that they're making from their $19.50 a shot. After the first 9 months, you'll have to stop me at some point here, right? But after the first 9 months, the CDC published a paper that basically said that it saved, the vaccine saved 1.6 million hospitalizations and 200,000 lives in just the first 9 months of their existence. Well, at an average cost, because if you're hospitalized with COVID, it is not cheap, depending on how severe and I've seen some numbers that it's $40,000 per hospitalization. That more than pays. That savings of 1.6 million people being hospitalized more than saves the cost that the government paid for the vaccine. And then, of course, you save hundreds of thousands of lives. Yeah. You know, it's mind-boggling how the industry, it gets attacked and quite unfairly in the vast majority of cases.
Yeah, I can empathize that. Yeah, when I took my kids to the CVS those three times, they always sat us in the toy and candy section afterwards to wait. So yeah, I pumped a lot of money into CVS during that and the boosters. But yeah, anyway, getting back to your book. So John, so Farm and Profits, Innovation, Medicine, and Drug Prices is the title. And I think in chapter six is a place where you really come full circle with all these points. You take the reader into sort of the graveyard where many biopharma programs go to die in recent years, namely Alzheimer's. You introduce the reader to the Aduhelm saga, where basically it's a mix of themes. Innovation is hard, especially in Alzheimer's, and very expensive. You can get creative and do things with biomarkers, but that's tough as well. There's phase four that people don't normally think about, but pharma dumps a lot of money after registration into to other forms of clinical evidence. And then, you know, I have to bring it up because it's happening right now as we're talking, so it's quite timely. But there's quite a bit going on out there in the ether in terms of the amyloid beta hypotheses, fraud in certain areas. I know that doesn't touch on the theme of the book, but I wonder if you could also pull that in. But talk about Aduhelm and a little bit of, because I think everything comes together really interestingly in this particular case.
So it's a great point, Ira. Thanks for bringing it up. In about 5 years ago, I wrote an editorial for Science Magazine. And the gist of the editorial was, look, I get it that patients really want drugs and want them as soon as possible, and that the FDA is too slow on approving drugs. And if I have a failure with a certain type of cancer, and in a early clinical study, it shows that it lowers a biomarker that tends to be predictive for that cancer, I want to have access to that as soon as possible. And the purpose of my editorial was, you can't approve drugs on biomarkers alone. There are too many examples out there where something looked very promising in phase two in a biomarker, and we'll use Alzheimer's as the example. In Alzheimer's, a beta amyloid is thought to be a marker for Alzheimer's disease, that if you have high beta amyloid levels, it gets into the brain and is the cause of the plaque that leads to cognition decline and the Alzheimer's fatalities. But my point was, just because you lower beta amyloid doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have an effect on the disease itself. It's promising. And for a company then to go the next step and invest $500 million, $1 billion in Alzheimer's studies to show that not only you're getting lowering of beta amyloid, but you're also having a beneficial effect on the disease is a pretty important step. And just approving it on the marker, I thought was a wrong thing. I thought that it was because it was Alex Azar in the Trump administration who was making noises about approving things on biomarkers alone, sort of like a buyer beware. You know, we're approving this. It seems to be safe, but, you know, it's no guarantee, but go ahead, try it. And I thought that was absolutely the wrong thing to do. And that was part of my editorial. Little did I realize that a few years later, Biogen, which had a drug which lowered amyloid pretty well, and eventually called Aduhelm, would run its two clinical trials, one of which didn't work. Yeah, you lowered beta amyloid, but you had no impact on cognition and help. And in the second study, it didn't really work, but in one subset of patients, you seemed to see an effect. And they went to the FDA with those data, and much to the surprise of the world, really, and even to the advisory committee, which the FDA had convened ahead of time. The advisory committee is made up of experts who the FDA will tap into each time they have a difficult decision to make on a new drug. And they voted against it 12-1, not approving it. The FDA went against that advice and approved the drug. The almost en masse, the advisory committee resigned, and not surprisingly, I probably would have done the same. And you know, why bother taking my advice and not going with it, particularly in something as important as this? And then what the icing on the cake was that Biogen decided to charge $56,000 a year for the therapy. Wow! Now, here's the problem. You have a loved one who's in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. You're going to want to get it. Hey, FDA has approved this. But we now have a second level of approval in this country, and that's insurance companies, which also is a major difference from years past. And the insurance companies basically said, oh, wow, we're not going to just approve this for everybody. And there was a lot of pushback. So much pushback that the first thing Biogen did was lower the price in half, which led pundits to say, well, you know, it doesn't work at $56,000. Why will it work at $28,000 a year therapy, which is correct. And what the FDA should have done was say, look, this is interesting. We want you to run another study, call it whatever you want, a phase four study, and here are the parameters. And if you do that, we'll approve the drug. In fairness to Biogen, the FDA said, we want you to run another study as well. But they gave Biogen 10 years to run it, which is insane. So That was a case where, look, I think the FDA has a tough decision. You've got, on the one hand, patients screaming for new therapies who desperately need them. On the other hand, you're trying to protect the world and the healthcare system from unnecessary expenditures on drugs which may have not yet been proven to work.
One of the things that you do a really good job of in the book is, you know, throughout it, you talk about some of the solutions that pharma is trying to put on the table, is putting on the table, specifically as it pertains to the pricing. You talk about some of these novel mechanisms that we didn't have years ago, money back guarantees, nominal pricing structures. You refer to as safety net facilities like prisons and other organizations. Obviously, we have the biosimilars, which, you know, has sort of chugged along a bit there in recent years, but maybe kicking up a bit. Talk a little bit about some of these sort of pharma solutions that we don't normally hear as much about. But, you know, at the same time that we're innovating and creating these products, we are thinking about these issues. We're not just thinking about the big numbers.
So I'll try and do this in two ways. I tell the story of how I once got into a cab in San Francisco going to the healthcare meeting, J.P. Morgan meeting, and the cab driver asked me as I was going to the meeting. I said, "Yeah, I am." And he said, "Well, you know, all these drug companies—they have cures for every disease." I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "Oh, they have cures, but what? How can they make any money if they cure diseases? No, they need to have people on their drugs for the rest of their lives. That's their business model." So I said, "Yeah, you can let me out at this next corner here. I'm fine." But he actually raised a pretty good point, which is now a viable point. You now, it's early stages, but with gene therapies, you can cure certain diseases. Yep. How do you price that? And so the example I use in the book is a cure for a certain type of leukemia, childhood leukemia. And what value do you put on that? How? So I can take this child who will die and restore the child to a normal life. Well, for the parents, of course, it's invaluable. It's whatever. But it's a business model that you do have to make some money. And so in the case I use, I believe the price for the drug was from Novartis' choice of $2 million, right, payable over 5 years, and which you if it doesn't work or if the effect wears off, I don't think they've put this into play yet, but people should be able to get the drug for a much lower price if it needs to be sustained. But that, I think, is a pretty good balance. Now, what do you charge for a year of life? You have a drug that gives you another year of life from cancer. I'm not talking about laying in bed with IV tubes. I'm talking about a real full year. That's not a debate we've had in this country, but that number exists in Europe, where when they're trying to set a price for a drug, they come out with about $50,000 a year in terms of therapy, in terms of value to the healthcare system. And so what do you do in this country? It turns out actually that the government has unofficially set a price for life. And that's because when the government wants to get a certain change, healthcare changes made and has to pass through Congress. So for example, getting new labels on cigarette packaging. Of course, various politicians will say, well, okay, but how do we know is this going to save us any money? And they'll do all sorts of calculations, lung cancer deaths, et cetera. But it's interesting, in their arguments, they will put a price on every year of life saved at $200,000. So I guess our Congress feels that life in the U.S. is worth four times that in Europe, which you can have a debate about. But nevertheless, there's no way if a drug company came and said, well, this is going to save a person in 20 years of life. And so, you know, it's worth $40 million. I mean, that's never going to happen. But there is a sense of if you give somebody a full life and what they end up paying for taxes and stuff like that and what they contribute to society, is certainly worth a lot when you turn things around and save lives. So that's one aspect of what you asked. The second aspect, though, is this country does a terrible job in using generic drugs. So we've got a great system in place, I think. You get intellectual property, what critics of the industry call a monopoly. Well, okay, yeah, it is a monopoly. You get a patent, and your patent lasts usually for a drug maybe 12 13 or 14 years. And then after that, generics come in and the price drops. A great example was Lipitor at Pfizer. Lipitor peaked at about $13 billion a year. And then it went off patent. And within a year, more than 90% of drug sales went away for Pfizer or went to generic drugs. The generic form of Lipitor, atorvastatin, I think 120 million prescriptions were written for atorvastatin last year. Costs pennies a pill. Pennies a pill, right? Dirt cheap. Statins have an unbelievable effect on reducing heart attacks and strokes. Tremendous, tremendous value. And that's the deal we have. The problem in this country is we don't use generic drugs enough. No doctor should prescribe Lipitor, brand name Lipitor. Should be obsolete now. It's amazing how much people spend on brand name Viagra. Which is also generic, and it's just stunning that the mystique of a little blue diamond pill, because generics can't sell it as a blue diamond, so I guess people don't think it works as well, whatever. But you had to do more generics, and we've been very slow on the more expensive drugs, which are the biosimilars, biological drugs, which tend to be very expensive, they're difficult to make, et cetera. But even there are things we can do to be saving money. So there are ways that we could be saving money in the healthcare system. I'm going to rail about something else while we're on the topic. Sure. There is no doubt that we spend more for drugs in this country than in Europe. That's a given. Question becomes how much? Most of the studies that you see talk about the list prices. And the list price that is published every year is not what insurance companies and others are actually paying, because that's the net price. Those tend to be secrets because those prices get negotiated. Nobody likes to give up, neither the insurance companies nor the drug companies want to give up. You know, I negotiated this with CVS, but I've negotiated this with United Healthcare, and it's competitive enough as it is. But it's probably not the degree that people think. Now, and by the way, drugs are only 14% of the overall healthcare bill. Hospitals, doctors, other providers are 85, 86% of it. So it's not that big a component of the healthcare bill. And yet, nobody talks about hospital costs. Yep. So, and this is amazing, but a hip fracture, I'm of an age now where I have a lot of friends now getting hip replacements. A hip replacement will cost $40,000. That technology is no different now than it was 20, 30 years ago. You might have a better type of hip now and material, but that's not going to drive $40,000. Hip replacement in France, $10,000. Mm-hmm. Poland, $2,500. Nobody ever talks about hospital costs or physician costs, et cetera. It's always on the drugs, which, by the way, if you had a magic wand and waved away all drug costs, and the rate of inflation in healthcare is such that the amount of healthcare costs now would be the same in 6 or 7 years, even without any cost to drugs. So nobody focuses on any of this stuff at all, which is drives me nuts, particularly when a lot of the major people criticizing the cost of drugs tend to be people in healthcare at hospitals and academic institutions, et cetera. You know, a little bit, you guys want to look at your own glass house first before you chuck your stones?
Yeah. Absolutely. John, last time we talked, you had just published a piece on drug truths at Forbes. And the title of the article was The Challenges in Bringing an Anti-Aging Pill to the Market. It talked about, you know, if one was to do a study on aging per se, you know, the numbers of patients you require, how long you'd have to do the study. You talked about, when we were talking about generics, you were talking about in the article about the TAME study, which is a generic drug, metformin, the targeting aging with metformin study, which was having some trouble at the time, sort of getting any financing to study a generic drug. But in recent months, there's been, on this sort of health economics front, there's been some papers published that talk about, you know, the scenario that if we could delay disease, even by a couple of years, sort of this health span concept, not that we would live, for 500 years, but if we just get sick a little later, The numbers are astronomical. I mean, they're bigger than the national debt. You can wipe out the national debt supposedly in a year. I'm just wondering, you know, it's been a couple of years since we chatted on that article. Have your views changed at all in terms of the longevity bioscience world? And, you know, are you seeing, as a venture capitalist now, as a mentor of companies, are you seeing anything interesting on the aging health span front that, you know, maybe it's not going to be as hard to develop anti-aging drugs in the future?
So there's a lot of science in the area, a lot of studies showing that you can do studies in mice and rats, and it looks like you can delay the aging process. That would be terrific. I think my baby boomer generation would love such a drug. And herein lies the problem. So if some reason a company were to come up with a drug that claims that to slow down the aging process, you're right, this would be the biggest blockbuster of all time. Everybody would take it. The FDA would obviously then be very, very cautious about approving such a drug, because on day one, it's not going to be just in 1,000 people or 100,000 people. It's going to be in millions of people, because all you have to do is be old to get it. You don't have to prove you're sick, right? So that's one. But then how do you prove to the FDA that your drug works? You can't take a population of 50-year-olds and give them the drug every day for 3 years and then show that they live to 90 or instead of 85. So then you have to say, okay, so you have to take older, equally matched population and show that they benefit from the drug. And then you're getting into people who are going to be older, potentially be sicker. And so it's a difficult population to study the drug in. So my guess is if you would ask somebody doing research in the area, say, well, we won't go for a longevity claim. We'll go for quality of life. We'll go and show people can walk further. People can get up and out of chairs more easily. And that might be doable, but that's not necessarily the fountain of youth drug that you talked about. And even there, you're not going to take 50-year-olds and do this. You're going to be taking 70, 75-year-olds and doing that there. So I think the development challenges and the FDA hurdles are pretty high in doing that. Is it fascinating research? Absolutely. If they come up with something that really worked, would I take it? Yeah, for sure, probably. But right now, red wine and exercise seem to be what I'm following.
Absolutely. And beer on my end, but
no resveratrol in beer. So you're a little
Sure. It tastes good. John, say a few words, if you would, about the John and Mary Lamatina scholarships. Because I know you've been doing a lot there, and it's not just science funding. You're involved in funding the humanities as well. Talk about some of what you've been up to on that front. Because I know, aside from biopharma and writing books and all this stuff, you're doing other things.
I'm a little surprised you're asking me about that. I didn't think it'd be an emotional question. I grew up in Brooklyn. My wife grew up in Brooklyn. My father had a Carvel. My wife is the oldest of six. Her father was a motorman. We got to go to college on scholarships. And I'm sorry. We're paying it forward, basically.
No, it's a I just wanted to, put it in part of the picture of who you were. But
we're fortunate enough to be able to do this. And
it's impressive. And I just wanted to make a part of the John Lamatina story, because I think it's something people should also know about. John, anything else that's hot that's going on? I mean, you're on many boards now. Obviously, you have to advise not just drug developers nowadays, but you're involved in digital health. You're involved in interesting microbiome research. What else is hot? Where else can we keep an eye out for you for the rest of 2022? Conferences you're going to be at? Other stuff happening? Please take the floor. And
anything else? I think that. it's already starting to happen, but in not too distant future, cancer is converted to a chronic disease. It'll be a disease where, okay, you have it, and if it can't be surgically removed, you will be under a cocktail. Like I said, it's already happening. It'll be under a cocktail of drugs that will keep your disease in remission, if not outright cured, I think. There's still some cancers that are tough, brain, pancreas, to name two right off the bat, but there are some now, like melanoma, that are we're getting to a good place, and I think we're getting closer, and things like breast cancer and stuff like that. So I think that's something we have to look forward to. Now, the challenge is pricing. These drugs tend to be expensive. But I think there's enough of them, and there'll be enough of them, that there'll be pricing competition, much like the hepatitis C drugs, that we'll get to a reasonable point. And so that's my hope. I think that cancer for my grandkids will be something that won't be something that they'll have to worry too much about. So I think that's probably one big thing. Alzheimer's, I'm not as optimistic about. I don't think, if you talked a little bit at the start of this session on the amyloid hypothesis, which now is coming into question. A lot of research has gone into this. Are there other mechanisms to look for? The challenge in Alzheimer's is again, comes down to testing of a drug. So do you take people at very early stages of Alzheimer's disease and follow them out for 5-6 years to see how they progress? And then you have to have a placebo control, obviously. So some people will not be getting the drug and others will. That's a long type of study. That's hard to do and expensive. Do you take people who are pretty far along in their disease and hope that you get reversal? That's also a hard kind of study. Once the plaques are there, how easy is it to reverse? So just finding the right kind of mechanism to study and then studying it chronically is very challenging. I think the big companies, the big pharma companies, can't afford to take multiple shots at an Alzheimer's approach. You might get one in each, but because of the amount of money you have to spend in doing it, it's a challenge to do. Rare disease therapies, however, a lot of companies are going into that, and I think you'll see a lot more diseases. The amount of R&D you need to come up with a drug for a rare disease is not that different from any other disease, but the clinical trials tend to be small, a couple of 100, 300 people. You can have a rare disease that costs the healthcare system $200,000 a year, and if you come up with a drug that treats that disease, you can charge $50,000 or $60,000 for it, and everybody wins along the way, and you can make money. And the clinical trials are small; you're talking about a few hundred people as opposed to 10,000. So I think more will happen there. I think therapeutic vaccines now. This mRNA technology looks very exciting, and not just for a new flu vaccine, but for other diseases along the way. That I think we'll be very optimistic about that. And then I think the great teaching of the pandemic has been in a crisis, and it'll only happen in a crisis. You get the FDA working very closely with companies. I mean, with the pandemic, there were weekly calls among the leadership of companies with the vaccine programs and stuff, and a great marshalling resource. Now, you can't do that for everything, right? The FDA would have to be 10 times, 20 times its size to be able to do something like that. But the amount of work going on in a crisis is encouraging that, you don't want another pandemic, but if another one, there's a blueprint already out there for how to deal with a pandemic, or maybe a bacterial infection that suddenly goes rogue that you need a new antibacterial for, that I think we have the wherewithal to be able to hopefully do something. We'll see.
Absolutely. John, it's always great talking to you. It's fascinating. It was a great book. Everybody that is listening, watching the show, please pick up a copy of Pharma and Profits, Balancing Innovation, Medicine and Drug Prices. Also, continue to follow John. If you don't right now, at his Drug Truths blog at Forbes. He has his other books available on Amazon. John, I appreciate you again taking the time out of your schedule to come educate us and talk to us for a little while about these important topics. Obviously, thank you for everything that you've been doing the last few decades on the human health front. And as we say on our show, thanks for helping to create a better tomorrow through everything you've been involved in. It's a really, really exciting story, and really appreciate you spending time with us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Ira. I really appreciate it.
Good seeing you.